You are listening to KDRT LP 95.7 here in Davis, California. My name is Lois Richter, and this program is called That's Life. Today, I am talking with Julie Harlow, and the reason that I'm talking with Julie Harlow is that at the end of February, when the invasion of Ukraine started, she, being a Quaker as I am, felt the need to have a place where people could come and pray for peace. Now, the Quakers called it holding them in the light. And so Julie she got a Zoom room, she opened it up, she sent links to all the meetings in our area and then all over the world, and invited anybody who wanted to come to a daily meeting for worship. And that's been going on since the end of February. Well, I happen to be in the same meeting as Julie is. We're our Quakers together. And I was helping her one day in the beginning. And since then, either she or I have been hosting or clerking or participating in this daily global worship. So today I have asked Julie to come and talk a little bit about some things. So this is Julie Harlow. Hello, Julie.
Hello, Lois. It is good to be with you on your radio program.
Yes. And we are recording this the May 28th, and it will go out sometime in June. So it's we record it on Zoom, and then we record it, then I edit it, and we make it in an hour, and I play it as a radio show. So, Julie, when you started this meeting, why and how did that happen? Was it just something that you thought about, or, as we say in Quakers, you were led to do? Why did it happen?
My first response when I heard about the invasion was one of shock and anger and grief and helplessness. And a friend who had been by my side with me through all of what I had done in the Soviet Union and the beginning of the nonprofit called Friends House Moscow, she called me and we cried together on the phone for a while. And her reaching out to me was a trigger for, there are more people who are going to need the support of each other. We need to be able to worship together. And we need it now, not after a clearance committee and a few meetings and passing a board and da da da. So I sent out an email that said, if nobody else is doing this, I'm starting a daily worship. And I sent it to a bunch of people and it got around. We did have to change the link once, but it's been consistent since then. And it has really been a blessing to me personally. And from what I hear of from the participants, it's been a real blessing to them too.
When it first started, and then people kept sharing the link, and so eventually there were people from all over the world coming. I remember the first time that I was there, and I think it was there like on day three or something, there were 500 people in the room. 500 people in a Zoom meeting in Quaker worship, sitting in silence and praying and doing all those things that Quakers do. That was a pretty astonishing response. Or was it?
Yes, it was. It was. When I started it, I didn't know whether 20 people or 50 would respond to it. But as the word went literally around the world on Quaker links, it grew and it met a need. Now, in the meantime, some other people had the same idea and they started a meeting. But all of those were one day a week or maybe 2 days a week. But the thing that was different about the one that I started is, number one, it was one of the first ones that simply got started and went out. The word went out. But it's also the most committed group and consistent. And because we meet daily, it has become a community.
And just so the listeners understand that this is a Zoom meeting, it means that individuals in their home, at whatever time of the day or night it is in their place, they're simply choosing to open their computers and get on a Zoom meeting. And there's no compulsion, there's no... It's all just because people either need the support or want to help other people, want to give the support. And so, yes, over the past couple of months, the number of people who are attending every day fluctuates. But we're down from the original 500, down to, 100, 120, something like that. And like on Saturday and Sunday, it's very light because there are other Quaker meetings and activities and things that people are doing. And so we might have 50, but then a couple of days later, there'll be 150. So let's talk about you had some thoughts, and I was going to ask you questions. And the first question I want to ask you is, who is coming to this meeting? What kind of a meeting is it? What's it for? Does it have a structure? How are we doing it? That sort of stuff.
I've heard it said that if you don't like organized religion, go to the Quakers. The meeting that we hold is called an unprogrammed meeting. And that means we don't have a service that is planned ahead. You don't get a pamphlet when you walk in the door that says we're singing this hymn and then we're passing the collection plate and then there's a sermon and then there's a hymn. We don't do that. We arrive, and if we're a little early, we visit with each other. And then we sit down and we become silent. And then we become still. Silent is you're not making noise, but still is you've calmed that monkey mind that brought in a whole agenda of things that it wanted to think about. And you've emptied those agendas and prepared an open space for spirit to move. One of our forefathers, Isaac Pennington, said, give over your own willing. You give up your agenda. And you open yourself to what spirit has for you. And sometimes spirit moves you in a way that says, this is a message for not just you, but for other people here. And you hold that and you try to move it aside. And if it just won't move aside, if it just won't let you go, then you may stand and briefly deliver your message. Now, those first few meetings where we had 400 or 500 people, I would say for at least a week and a half, we were in the 300 and 400 every day. They were pretty busy meetings. There was not a lot of silence. And it was, I think, the cathartic experience of having a place where people would listen and you could say how much you hurt. You could say how angry you were. You can say how confused you were with our government sending weapons of violence? But they're going to somebody that's being attacked for no reason that they gave. So support from other Quakers was very important in being able to share all of that. But it did not make for a still meeting.
I think that one of the things that that happened in those early days is that people came from lots of different places, lots of different ways of dealing with spirit, the divine, God, whatever you want to call it, the light. And so some people had written material. I mean, they had like they were going to be a preacher and they were going to say their say. And so it took a while for Julie mostly and me a little bit to, I think, gently explain what an unprogrammed meeting was. And then we gave people a way of communicating all those other things in either small discussion groups after meeting for worship or in writing something down and sharing it in the chat, or so the ways that people could be heard, they could put a link, they could whatever. And slowly over the weeks, I think that your description of what an unprogrammed worship meeting is like became accepted, and the people who didn't want that may have gone to other places. So right now, it is quite common to have an entire hour of meeting for worship and only have one or two or no vocal ministry.
And that's okay. That's good. That feels centered. It feels so much more like holding than the... We call them popcorn meetings, where as soon as one person is sat down, the next one stands up.
Well, they can't do popcorn meetings here because the clerk and the host, it's a Zoom meeting. And for various security reasons and also to make the flow better, we mute everyone when meeting for worship starts. And the first 10 minutes, nobody gets unmuted, so they cannot say anything. And then if they want to say something, fine, they give their ministry. But then the clerk doesn't immediately call on the next person who wants to give ministry. Oh, no, you gotta wait a few minutes so that we can absorb what the last message was before we're ready to listen to another message.
I wish, looking back, that I had written down each day what we did, because it was a developmental process.
Yes.
It was looking at the spirit and tempo of the meeting, how to keep it a meeting for worship and not a news report, and how to keep it safe. And you really brought in the safety measures that we could do, which combined with things like making people wait 3 minutes before they speak after the last person, help to give the meeting the depth that it has now. Mm-hmm. And it is also a fact that when you have 50 to 80 people in a meeting, you will probably have less people who want to speak than when you have 500.
Absolutely.
So just the kind of reduction. Now, one thing I find interesting is that there were 500 several meetings, and definitely in the 400s and then the 300s and so forth. And I was sending the invitation out every day so that people knew that it hadn't changed, or if they just wanted right at the top of their mailbox, they would have it. And there's still 180 people on that list. Mm-hmm. So there are 180 people who said a week and a half ago, I want to receive the notice every day. I want that reminder. So I believe that there are 180 people who are holding Ukraine and everyone affected by the war in Ukraine in the light, whether they come to our meeting or not.
And there are people who come certain days and then they have obligations other days. Or I've actually had one of the participants say that it's supportive, but it's stressful because when they come to meeting in the morning, for us it's morning because it's a 9 a.m. Pacific time. But when they come, it's work, it's stress, it's hard for that person. And so they said, well, I have to take some time off just so I have me time. And I also, when I'm there, I am working, I'm focused. I'm not usually in silent worship, except for maybe the first 10 minutes, but usually I'm focused on what I'm doing. And so it's not like being in meeting. But anyway, there are people who come and are there some days and not other days. And that's, so I wouldn't be surprised at all if you have more than the 180. I know some people don't get the daily thing because we talk about it and they say, oh, well, no, I can't look that up. And I don't get that. In case the listeners are wondering, when we're talking about safety, this is a Zoom meeting. It was widely distributed the link to get into it, and some people who wanted to disrupt the meeting did come in one day, and that was the, and my reaction to that, shutting it down that first day, and then Julie and I figured out ways to try and keep those disruptors at bay, and so they tried a couple more times, but that's it. Then they haven't been able. They haven't been able to do anything, and so they haven't bothered coming back, as far as we know. So that is all in the past. That was like the beginning of March that happened, and it hasn't happened since then. So now our procedures, although we do a few things that we do for security, most of our procedures are for making the meeting comfortable and flowing and helping people get into, not only into worship, but get into the technology enough that it doesn't get in the way. So Julie, in the daily meeting, we have lots of different kinds of Quakers that come, some from unprogrammed meetings, some from program meetings and things like that. What sort of Quakers are there that you know of that might have been there, or that isn't even the right question. The question is, how many different kinds of Quakers are there? Aren't we all the same?
We are definitely not all the same. I attended a Quaker church, a friend's church, and introduced myself and said that I was from an unprogrammed meeting, and they looked shocked. And three people came up afterwards and said, are there really unprogrammed meetings? And we don't know about each other. So there's a spectrum of Quakers, a range of attitudes and the way we live the beliefs that we have in common, and some beliefs that have evolved differently. They all go by the title of Religious Society of Friends. We're all under that name umbrella, but not under any organizational umbrella. There are programmed or pastoral meetings, the Evangelical Friends Church and Friends United meeting have churches that have pastors and hymns and pass the plate and what you would expect in a Protestant service. There is a small group of what they call themselves conservative friends because they conserve the old method of worship and it's very Bible-centered. But they don't have a pastor. The liberal unprogrammed tradition is the one that Lois and I belong to a meeting that is in that category. And many people say we got rid of the pastors. It's not true. We got rid of the passive laity. We're all ministers. And when you settle into silence in an unprogrammed meeting, you settle with an expectation, not an expectation that you'll speak, but an expectation of being still and being open and receiving. And that's very different kind of responsibility than when you know the pastor's going to do all the work. Our silent meeting in Davis has about 35 members and 20 to 30 on each Sunday. There are some that have 100, 200, 300. The meetings, the branches of Quakerism that are the largest by number are the pastoral ones, the Evangelical and Friends United meeting, because they do a lot of missionary work. And so they have huge numbers of people in South America and in Africa that affiliate with that church and are members of that branch. So they are very big by numbers. And this branch of Quakerism does not proselytize. We don't go out and try and convert people. We think you're fine just the way you are. And so we don't grow very quickly. And in fact, in California, at least, we're shrinking.
So there's all these different branches. What sort of response did Quakers around the world have to that invasion of Ukraine? Were we all doing the same thing? Or do you even know what other people were doing?
There are several sites that I would go to as an unprogrammed friend to find out what Quakers are doing. I did Google, because that's the way you find things. I Googled the Evangelical and the Friends United and the Conservative, and I could not find the word Ukraine on their website. It didn't show up. So it could be that individual meetings are doing things, but the organizations that are online don't seem to be. That's my assumption just from that search. I would go to FWCC, Friends World Committee on Consultation, which is a worldwide organization, and it has sections in the Americas, Africa, Europe, and Asia. And it lists things that are being done, concrete actions people are taking that you could support or you could join. Western Friend is a magazine produced for the three yearly meetings, large groups of Quakers in the West. And it has lists online of meetings for worship. And there are some now that are listed there that were not listed when I started the one that I did. Mm-hmm. The other place I would go to is Friends General Conference. And sometimes there are special workshops or notices or things there about what Friends are doing. It wasn't from any of those sites. It was from personal contact that I learned what Quakers are doing in Europe. Mm-hmm. I'm one of the founders of a small nonprofit that began in 1996 and has been working for 26 years in Russia and the region. And it's through contacts there and the board that I have learned about Quakers in Poland who were asking for donations to start a center for refugees, Ukrainian refugees that were coming in. And there is a movement in Estonia by one of the Quaker meetings there, or by the Quaker meeting there, to support AVP, Alternatives to Violence Project, in Estonia.
What is Alternatives to Violence Project?
There were a group of incarcerated men in Greenhaven Prison in New York in the mid-1970s who recognized that the people who were there did not have any personal recourse to deal with conflict, accept violence, and they needed to learn to be different. And if they left the prison with the same set of skills they came in with, they would be violent again and be back in prison for longer. So one of them knew about Quakers, that they were a peace church. So they contacted the local Quaker meeting and said, we want help developing a program to teach people to have other resources instead of violence to react to conflicts. So the program was designed to go in prison, but it's also used in community groups and different places. It teaches communication skills on a deep level. It teaches you to hear the other person's point of view. It teaches you other ways to react to a threat, like humor or surprise or finding common ground. And one of the most wonderful things about Alternatives to Violence Project is it will take you in some very deep territory, and then you play a game. And the Light and Livelies are just a wonderful break in that tension. And especially in prison, where the incarcerated are really not allowed to joke. You better be serious and on your guard all the time. And here they're learning to play things, the equivalent of pin the tail on the donkey, but you're moving. It's they're lively games, and they break the tension. And then you have the energy to go back deep again. And many of the men who experience, I've only worked with men, but many of the incarcerated who've had that experience, when they come back for the second level training, they said the reason they came back was the Light and Livelies. It was the only moment in their incarceration where they forgot they were in prison.
It sounds like you have taught this as well. Is this now, this, it started in the mid 70s and has expanded from there. I'm assuming that anytime a Quaker meeting is doing something, they're going to be filtering out to other meetings. So how did you end up on that? Did you start teaching that?
It's taught. We don't call it teaching because it's an experience. It's an experience. So you have facilitators.
Uh-huh.
That guide you in the exercises, and then you do them. And if you have four facilitators, one of them is guiding and the other three are participating. So it's a participatory, experiential thing. My friend, Kay Anderson, had been involved in AVP for a long time, and she kept saying to me, Julie, you're going to love it. You're going to want to do this. You're going to love it. Please take the training. Please. And I kept saying no. And finally, she broke me down. And there was one close to me. It was on a weekend. I could do it. Okay. I will come and do the training. So I did the basic workshop with her. Afterwards, she came up to me excitedly. And she said, well, what did you think? And I said, I think this is the most miraculously transforming, uplifting, wonderful program, and I'm going to get as far away from it as I can.
Because you knew you were going to fall in and start. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Once I got in, I just would not be able to do anything else. And at the time, I was trying to set up this project in Russia. So I stayed away from it until I retired. Mm. And when I knew I was going to be retiring that spring, I started taking the other two workshops. Mm-hmm. So when my students asked me, what are you going to do after you retire? I said, well, I'm going to Singapore to visit my niece. I'm going to Moscow to visit my program. And I'm going to prison. And my students said, what are you doing in Moscow that they're going to send you to prison? No, I'm going to come home and I'm going to do these workshops in prisons, because the people who are incarcerated have made mistakes, but they are not mistakes. And they can have a better life, even if it is in prison, if they have some skills so that they have some resort other than violence.
Mm-hmm. How big is this program now? Is it all over the world?
70 countries.
Wow.
70 countries. I contacted a facilitator in Singapore when I was there, but unfortunately we just couldn't pull anything together. It was too short a notice. Couldn't do anything. But there is an ABP program in Ukraine. There's one in Russia. There's one in Latvia and Estonia. I'm not sure about the other former Soviet republics, but online there's a map, and boy, there's just dots everywhere. So 70 countries around the world.
Mm-hmm. Where, if someone wanted to look up that map, what website would they be looking at?
You would go to AVP, Alternatives to Violence Project International.
So we don't know the actual website URL. They just look it up, Google it.
You Google, yeah.
So when you were when you were talking about that, you were talking about your project in Moscow called Friends House Moscow. Can you tell us a little bit about what that is and how it got going?
In 1991, the Soviet Union collapsed. Quakers around the world saw this as an opening for some kind of useful, helpful interaction with the people of Russia, especially with the people of Russia. And I was one of those. I happened to be leading a Quaker peace tour at the time that the Soviet Union collapsed. I was in Moscow.
Oh, wow.
I went to Leningrad. And when I went to sleep, I woke up in the same bed, but I was in a different city. It was now called St. Petersburg. Everything was just changing really quickly. And I saw a vision of a Quaker center in Moscow to help grassroots organizations, grassroots groups, turn themselves into organizations and get things done. And in 93, I connected with a group of people who all had some kind of vision for what they thought they could do that would be useful and helpful in Russia. And after we shared all of our different ideas, they all sat in silence for a while, and then each one of them said, if there isn't a center there, I can't accomplish what I want to accomplish. I need somebody there to help with logistics and stuff. And then the next person would say, well, I can't do it unless there's a center. So it was what Quakers call unity.
Y'all agreed you needed a center.
We agreed. And so we were given the task of going back to our constituent areas, finding out if there was support for that. Came back in 6 months, and there was. And they asked me to clerk the first meeting. And so I went to Moscow, and there were people there from Quakers. They're from Norway, Germany, Holland, United Kingdom, US, and Russia, and Ukraine. And we had a 3-day meeting to brainstorm and figure out what is this thing we are trying to create, and what should it be called, and what kind of a board do we need? What are we going to try to accomplish? So that was the beginning of it. And by 96, we had the fundraising pieces of it in place, and we opened our doors in 96. So we've been serving for 26 years.
And what did you decide to call it?
Well, we had been calling it Friends Center. Mm-hmm. You can't call it Friends House because that's confusing for Americans who think a house is a place where people live. And you can't call it Friends House because the translation is Dom Druzhe and Dom Druzhba, House of Friendship, was the propaganda center that tourists were taken to learn about how peaceful the Russian people are. So we were advised, you can't call it anything that sounds like Dom Druzhba. So, okay, we'll just call it Friends Center. Then when we have Russians on the board, and I said, what do we call it? It's Friends Center, okay. And the American said, yes, definitely. And the European said, yes, definitely. And the Russians all said, absolutely not. because the Russian word for center starts with a T-S, but it's pronounced center. It's obviously an English word that's borrowed. It's a foreign word. It's not a Russian word. And Russians will not be comfortable going there. They will think it is an office for foreigners.
Propaganda from the West.
You have to name it something that is warm and inviting and homey. Home. Dom Druge. So that's what we are. And I said, but won't that get confused with Dom Druzhba? And they said, no, the term has been rehabilitated. So it was okay to call it Dom Druge. So that's the name of it.
So it's Friend's House.
It's Friend's House, Moscow. We had two purposes. One was to support the little group of Quakers that was in Moscow. And the other was to support the little grassroots efforts to address some of the many ills that were left over from the Soviet period.
And how are you connected to Ukraine? What's going on there?
So when I was teaching seventh grade in the early 1980s, my students were all really afraid of nuclear war. And so I went on a teacher's tour. And one of the cities that we visited was Kiev. And we visited a lot of different children's facilities in Kiev. So I had kind of a feel for the city. I also connected with a pen pal of a friend. And so I had a personal connection in Kiev. I subsequently organized five more tours, and we always went to Kiev. And so there's a familiarity with the city. There's a sense of picking up enough of the culture to feel comfortable there. Mm-hmm. And then the AVP facilitators in Ukraine have come several times to Moscow when we have the board meeting for Friends House Moscow. And so I know them personally, particularly Ala Soroka, who I believe is in Greece right now. And that group was doing AVP workshops after the invasion of Crimea, when tensions and hostilities between Ukrainians and ethnic Russians was very high all over the country. And they were doing lots of workshops, inviting half ethnic Ukrainians and half ethnic Russians. And at the beginning of those workshops, those people lined themselves up along the wall by ethnicity and would have nothing to do with the other group. There was just that much animosity and hostility. And by the end of the workshop, they were hugging each other and crying and exchanging phone numbers. And AVP is an absolutely miracle worker, mm-hmm. with dissolving tensions. And this program was developed especially to do that. And this is the kind of program that's being developed in Estonia, which has the triple threat of the local Estonians, the resident ethnic Russians, who the Estonians really resent that they're still there, and then the incoming Ukrainian refugees. And it's a boiling pot. It's an area where tensions could turn violent at any moment. So they are doing workshops, bringing the three ethnic groups together to break down those hostilities and help them see each other for their common humanity. I hope you'll do a program on AVP and have a couple of really experienced.
I would like that. Is Kay still doing it?
I don't think that she would come. Carrie Schender,
uh-huh,
who's here in Davis, and Ellen Eggers are the two people that I would recommend. And I could find some other names of people close by.
Yeah.
Who would.
Because it's on Zoom, it doesn't matter if they're close by or not. So maybe I'll contact AVP, and they might have people who go on shows and talk about the program as what they do. So I'll find someone somewhere somehow. Anyway, that's good. So AVP still exists, and it's spreading and it's working. Is it Quaker?
It was developed by a mixed group of incarcerated men and Quakers.
Mm-hmm.
When you go to a workshop, you are very likely to find one or more Quakers among the facilitators, mm-hmm, but it's not strictly Quaker.
So it's not a religious affiliated organization?
No. It's not religious at all. It's not affiliated with any religion, and it is not about teaching people that they're sinners and have to behave. It's about listening to who they are and helping them see a different way to react to somebody else. It's not religious.
So we only have a few minutes left, and I was wondering where you see our daily meeting going. Now, just so that the listeners understand, it's an hour unprogrammed worship. Well, actually, it's 55 minutes, so that people have 5 minutes to get to where they have to go next. And then afterwards, we have little discussion groups where people can get together in small groups and talk about lots of different things. And some of them are very serious, and some of them are a little more lighthearted. And we also have, we keep open a special room for more silent worship. So if somebody wants to go in there and keep on going, that works too. So what do you see our group morphing into?
I don't see it morphing, because to me, that's metamorphosis. It's a transformation.
Mm-hmm.
I see it as a community.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that we will be necessary as a community for quite a while.
Mm-hmm.
The tragedy and trauma that is happening is going to have to be addressed.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the participants in our group are preparing their homes to take in the Ukrainian individual or family. Some are involved in the humanitarian supplies that are needed. Some are writing letters to powers that be. And when the conflict stops, when there is no more, there will still be healing work that needs to be done.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that Friends House Moscow is going to be involved in that, in sponsoring trauma healing programs and PTSD treatment. And I believe that our meeting will continue daily for as long as there are people who need that daily support. It may change to 3 times a week instead of 7. That's something that the members of the group will decide, the participants. I think that we will be holding in the light all of those affected by the war for a very long time. I don't know if that means a year or 2 years. I don't know, but I don't see it as the shooting has stopped, so we won't meet again. This is a community that is going to continue to support each other in some fashion.
I agree with you. I think that's right. I do think, and it may have already happened, that there will be some spin-offs of this, so that maybe one of the discussion groups that happens every single day might eventually decide that, you know, 40 minutes after isn't enough, and they're going to go open their own room and do their own thing. And so I can see spinoffs like that. The actual meeting for worship seems to me like it will probably be indefinite, but I could see it expanding to more than just what we started about. We started about the invasion of Ukraine. But now, yesterday, this morning, I heard a lot of people praying for others who are harmed, who are endangered, who, you know, are so in sorrow and grief. And so I can see that there might be even more that becomes part of this.
We have opened the chat the last 5 minutes of the meeting for worship for people to put in names of individuals they would like to have held in the light. And there are many names there. And I think that is a support to the individual. But many of us really believe in the efficacy of prayer, mm-hmm. and that prayer for someone helps that person. Mm-hmm. We believe that meeting together, we support each other in breathing peace into the atmosphere, breathing the idea that peace is possible, keeping that vision open. I don't think that's going to wear out.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot of silence happening these days, and sometimes that's very powerful ministry. And people on the radio hearing this going, what? Silence ministry? What? Yeah, well, come and try it out. And maybe it'll make more sense then. Yeah.
I think I was on an airplane, and somebody asked my t-shirt on or something. They asked me about Quakerism, and an hour of silence, right? I could never do that. And I said, can you imagine being in a library and getting a book and just reading it silently for an hour?
Sure.
Oh, yeah,
sure.
I could do that. Sure. And I said, well, it's kind of like that. But everybody's got a different book. But all of them are about peace. Mm-hmm. And once in a while, somebody reads something that just, they've got to share it. And they'll stand up and say it and sit down, and you listen, and then you go back to your book. And she said, oh yeah, I could do that. Yeah.
It's interesting how different people decide whether or not to give ministry. And I am one who I try to calm and center. It's almost like getting ready to go to meditation, cleaning out the noise in my head, and something about, okay, now what's on the grocery list, and you just sort of let it go. You don't have to deal with that now. And then when you get a message, you hear something or feel something or know something. And sometimes I'll get a message and it'll be an answer to a problem I've been working on. And I go, oh yeah, well, thank you, God, for that solution, you know? And sometimes I can't figure out what problem it's solving. And that's when I think, well, maybe this is for somebody else. I think sort of sometimes it's easier for the divine to get through to certain people than to certain other people. And so sometimes I'll get a message and I will, as you say, it's like you're being poked in the rear end. You better stand up, Lois. It's time to stand up and say something now. And I've done that occasionally and found afterwards, after meeting is over, this is in our own meeting house, and people would come up to me and say, thank you for that. That solved my problem, or that answered my question, or that moved me. And so I'm less resistant than I used to be to giving ministry. What I find very strange is when I get something, I rehearse it in my head. I try and get it concise and make sure that it's not my brain doing it, but it's inspiration doing it. And then when I stand up and I say it and I sit down, if I'm crying, I know I got it right. But sometimes I don't have a clue what I said. I mean, I gave the message, but it may not have been exactly the words I was planning on using. Is that how it feels to you? Or you don't do ministry very often.
I used to do it more. And I think that I am more settled than I used to be. Mm-hmm. And I'm perhaps better at telling which messages are for me and which messages are to share. I'm not sure. But also, for about 5 or 6 years now, messages come to me in rhyme.
Oh.
And when a message starts in rhyme, I write it down. And sometimes when I get finished, I know that I'm supposed to share it. Mm-hmm. And sometimes when I get finished, I know that was just for me. Mm-hmm. And sometimes the rhyme comes with a tune. And it turns into a song. I don't think I have shared any of those as ministry. I think I might have shared the poem that it started with. But I believe that the right lobe of the brain has the center for spirituality. The left brain is linear and logic and right and left, you know, sequential stuff. And religion, spirituality is just not like that. Mm-hmm. It's taking in a huge concept without asking, is that reasonable? can I prove that? It's suspending disbelief, mm-hmm. and not demanding proof, but experiencing. Mm-hmm. The truth. And music is a pathway into the right lobe. Mm-hmm. So for me, music is a spiritual pathway. And I believe that it's true for many people. Mm-hmm.
The artistry of being human, I think, is part of the maker's art, if you want to express it that way. That inspiration happens in lots of different ways. And it's not, here we go. This is something I really want to say. Being a Quaker means that I think that God can talk to anybody. Now, whether or not they listen, that's up to them. But it's possible. And so God can talk to me. So I can get a message. I can get instructions. I can get, what should I do? Oh, I should do this. And being a Quaker, one of the most strong benefits of it is that when I get those instructions, I can turn to you and to other people in our meeting, and I can say, this is what I think I'm supposed to be doing. And you can say to me, Lois, I think maybe you put the comma in the wrong place here, and it really means something else. And so having a group of people that I can use to confirm or clarify my inspiration and the message I think I got. And to me, that is really, really important. That's probably even more important than being in meeting for worship.
We have a process that might exist in other forms, in other places. We call it a clearness committee. Not clearance. We're not selling anything. Clearness. Are you clear about what you're doing? Mm-hmm. And the process is that the subject person who has the question or thinks they know what to do or thinks they don't know what to do explains the situation and the others ask questions, but they're not questions like, oh, did you try calling so-and-so? They're questions like, how does it feel in your body when you say you're going to do this? How would this affect the rest of your life? They are thought-provoking questions, not detail, nitty-gritty stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a clearness committee. I was considering resigning and retiring and going on the road. And I called three people and said, can you meet with me tomorrow? And they did. And after I told them what I was going to do, friends said, Julie, you sound like you know what you're doing and you really want to do it. Why are we here? And I said, I need to know that it's a leading.
Yeah.
That I'm not just running away from a job I don't like and hitting the road because that sounds like fun. Because sometimes I'm going to be challenged out there. I really need to know, is this God speaking to me or just ego and fear? What? I need to know that it's a leading.
Mm-hmm.
And we sat in silence for a while. And then the friend said, Julie, just because there's a lot of good reasons to do something doesn't mean it's not a leading. Yes, it's clearly a leading. Mm-hmm. It's clearly a leading. And that process is wonderful, wonderful for everybody involved.
And so Julie has been traveling around the country with Friends House Moscow and visiting Quakers and all that stuff. And today she came and she was on my show. This is Julie Harlow that we're talking about. She's a friend of mine. She's a Quaker. And I want to thank you for having been on the show. Thank you. Thank you, Julie.
Thank you for the interview. You've given me some things to think about.
Oh, good. I was a clearness committee of one.
Yeah.
As were you. All right. Thank you, friends, for listening. And I will hope you come back some other time. This is Lois Richter. The program is That's Life. Today's guest was Julie Harlow. And you're listening to KDRT LP 95.7 Davis, California.